Hey guys, welcome to Between the Pints, your source for the business side of craft beer. I'm your host, Aaron Gore, aka Chief Redbeard, and I'm here with my co-host,
Ryan Moses, the beer counselor,
as well as
Carly Smith from Bold Missy.
Hey Carly, what do you do for Bold Missy?
I am their new brewmaster, about 2 months in.
Excellent. Okay, so real fresh face. All
super
right, beautiful.
Fresh.
Yeah. We're happy to have you on the show. Ryan, let's get started with a little what's going on in your life. What's happening in the life of Rye?
Well, right now, just working every day, and yesterday I celebrated the February 10th last year. I thought I was having a heart attack.
Okay, wow. So nothing major. Yeah. That's good to hear.
It turned out to be just high blood pressure, but it triggered a whole series of events where I've changed a lot of my life, and I've lost a lot of weight, met Leah, my girlfriend, and things are much better.
Sweet Jesus, man. Yeah, well, all right then. Yeah. Tough to follow that.
And I'm also planning to see Black Panther Friday, which is the most important thing, actually, at the moment.
Yeah, oh, no, that's going to be absolutely huge. We were talking about this before the show. Like, I've had my tickets for, like, 2 months now. Like, yeah. Basically, as soon as the theater put them on sale, I'll be seeing them Sunday, just because I'm going to be working basically Thursday through Saturday. Yeah. But I'm pretty pumped for that movie.
Yeah, I'm pretty much leaving the bar Friday night and going straight to whichever theater we're going to.
But Cinemark, you said, right?
The Cinemark on Monroe Road, yes.
Yeah, so I'm glad that everybody at home who doesn't live in Charlotte will know exactly where that is.
Dude, I live in Charlotte and I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
Yeah, again, you've been here for 2 months.
I should know, right?
Easy newbie. Yeah, you should know every single street in the city. No, Cinemark's a real plush place, man. Like I feel like this is turning into a freaking ad for Cinemark. No, they have like these nice, sweet leather seats that I swear, like I'm a decent-sized guy and I could practically swim in them, and full recliners. They have love seats, man.
Yeah, they have love seats and a bar.
Yeah, and a full bar with like 25 taps of craft beer.
Yes.
I love Cinemark. Yeah, and I promise this wasn't paid for by them. I would gladly donate my services to a commercial. I chose my current house partially because of its proximity to that place.
Oh, my gosh.
I wish I was lying. My wife's outside. We can grab her. She'll back it up.
Oh, my gosh.
Excellent. Yeah, so for me, I got March 2nd, so coming up quick is going to be my retaking of the tasting portion of the Cicerone exam. Both Ryan and myself are failed prospective Cicerones, let's put it that way. Yeah. And there's a bit of stigma around that. You got a lot of people who really kind of gets in their head about the fact that they didn't pass. And I mean, the pass rate for the frickin' test is worse than the bar.
Yeah. I mean, I have my written test the 20th of this month coming up. So I've been studying for that.
Yep. Kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
You're doing that. Where are you doing that at?
I'm going to Asheville.
Asheville, you know, the Napa Valley of beer. Yeah, that's one of those things I just think that people need to be open about talking about that, because there's a lot of prospective Cicerones who they get discouraged hearing about people failing, and you got a lot of people who failed once and they just never retaken. And for me, it's the opposite. We should be able to talk about this fact and learn from those experiences and, you know, go back, try again, get that certification, and then, you know, channel that into the next phase of your career or your experience with beer.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult test, and it's created to be difficult on purpose.
They're kind of sadists.
Yeah. I will say that is the second tasting I did. I think it was the second tasting, but whichever tasting test I reached, whichever one of the tasting tests it was, the way it's set up, there's a portion where you have to just tell which style of beer it is. And this particular test, they decided to make one style. Is it an American porter or is it an English porter?
Which that's man,
that's mean.
That's
just
low.
That's just being
that
mean.
That is definitely aiming low. American porter and English porter. I mean, for those of you who might not be aware, really the only primary difference aside from small level of alcohol content is the hop level. And the problem is a lot of American porters are actually English porters. They're just not labeled that way.
Yes.
And we don't get in. This is not the time or place to get into that. But one thing you will see is a lot of those traditional English styles, even when they're made in America now and they're labeled as an American version, are almost invariably closer to the English definition. You see that with barley wines all the time. Almost every barley wine on the market, with a handful of exceptions, is the English-style barley wine. And most of them are still labeled as American-style barley wine. So without getting too far off track, that's a bit of a low blow trying to catch on that.
But I did – actually, that is the test I passed, the tasting portion that I passed. So it was
– oh, yeah, brag.
I got lucky. I'm not going to lie.
All right. Well, how about some brew news? What do you got for us, Ryan?
The first thing is from craftbeer.com. There's an article that went up this week called Inside the Craft Beer Cold War. And basically the writer compares the current state of craft beer between the small craft brewers and big beer as the same as the US-USSR Cold War from the latter half of the 20th century.
Not hyperbole at all, people.
No, not at all.
Yeah, the beer nuclear wars are about to start.
Yeah, I mean, and like reading it, I couldn't quite... I've read it a few times, and I still don't know if I agree with any or all of what it said or disagree with any of all of what it said, but...
Glad you recommended this article yeah. that you're I mean, it's just like sure you agree with.
I think the reason I recommend it is partly it the one thing that I did agree with it does matter where your beer comes from, whether you buy from a...
Usually from a brewery is what I've found.
A small brewery who cares about taste and flavor and using good ingredients, or a big beer company who treats beer as a widget. And they're trying to sell it with as high a margin as possible, which means they're going to use whatever great ingredients they can find that are as cheap as possible and jack the price up as high as possible to sell it through retailers. And it doesn't matter who you buy your beer from,
I think,
in my opinion.
One of the things that with this whole conversation that I've picked up on that I think is really important for people to understand is the lack of transparency
yes.
with big beer. Like, you know, this is how business has been run for forever.
But Carly, there's four essential ingredients in beer: water, hops, yeast, and rice.
Oh, no. Yeast isn't an ingredient because we filter it out.
Oh, yeah, it was barley. Yeah,
barley.
That's what it was. Yeah. So glad they filled us in on that.
Yep. And, you know, cold lagering, that's huge.
Oh, yeah, cold as opposed to warm lagering. I've heard great things about that process.
But yeah, I think them just not being transparent about the craft beer breweries that they have acquired and kind of using that to kind of get into our industry, that's been the biggest thing that I think is harmful to the craft beer, is people aren't understanding what is and isn't craft anymore.
Yeah, and I know.
Even overseas, you see a lot of breweries that a lot of people over here who are like, oh yeah, at least the imports are safe. A lot of them aren't. I mean, something like 5 of the 6 largest breweries in Munich are owned by outside interests. Spaten yes. is owned mm-hmm. by ABI, and a lot of people yeah. don't realize that. And mm-hmm. I've broken a couple of hearts even with people who are very much in the know about the beer scene. You know, I know you love Optimater, but yeah. I'm sorry, man. That's going right in the same pocket that Wicked Weed
is. I was speaking to a German brewer who one of our reps brought by, and he was like, yeah, I've told people exactly that Spaten's owned by ABI. And they're just like, look at me. And he was like, yeah, they look at me like I'm crazy. And I'm like, no, this is true.
Yeah, I'm not making this up. And one of those things, it's one of those things, like the more you say it, the more it sounds like a grand conspiracy. Like I was trying to explain this to a friend of mine who's not a big beer geek at all the other day. And he was just looking at me like I needed to throw my tinfoil hat on halfway through the damn conversation. And I understood where he was coming from, because it's one of those things. It seems like all these various threads can't possibly be going to the same place, but they are. If this was anything other than beer, it'd really almost be inconceivable, but it's happening.
Well, I will say I worked for a large home improvement warehouse store, and one day I just started cursory investigation using the Google machine.
Heard about that.
Yeah. And apparently, like, if you do it, I found out that pretty much all the things sold in that particular store, there might have been 10 companies that owned everything, and I would say 6 owned probably 75 or 80%. Once you like go through all the different threads to all the holding companies and all the everything, you basically find that there's probably only 6 or 7 companies that deal with this particular large warehouse.
Thank you guys for tuning into Between the Pines, the Conspiracy Theorist podcast. The truth is out there. Yeah, so what else you got for us today? Because we'll definitely
we will
do a whole episode.
Lighten up
it, yeah. And yeah, let's move on to lighter subjects, because none of mine are light at all. This,
yeah. Well, the other two articles I have both come from this, the Brewers Advocate magazine that I
Beer
got.
Advocate?
Beer Advocate magazine that I got last week, the current issue. One is called A Festive Shift.
By the way, we should totally do like Between the Pints bingo, where if one of us forgets the name of like a major publication, you'd mark off the spot,
because
that's happened every episode so far. Or that's much better. I like that. We're gonna play Pong. You won't be able to see it, but we'll be having a great time.
The article, A Festive Shift, it's just how beer festivals are changing right now in craft beer, where everybody kept making the same beer festival based on the GABF, which is you get a big room and you put a bunch of tables in, and then you have breweries come in and you get have people line up in the cattle call and get their sample. And what's happening is because everybody does that, that's really not a fun thing outside of GABF, just because of the sheer size.
It's become an excuse to get drunk.
Yes, yeah.
Which I think we can all agree is fun, but it really does kind of undermine what those festivals were really meant to showcase, and that was the beer itself.
Yeah, that it, like, and if you've been to like GABF or any other big beer festival like that, the last hour of the beer festival is just complete and utter chaos, because you have people running around trying to find the highest ABV
at or the hoppiest.
Or the hoppiest. Okay. And just
what do you got that's like got the most IBUs? I want like all that. I really
my Russian Imperial
IPAs.
Stout.
No, I like only IPAs. You know, IBUs.
Yes.
IBUs, Carly. IBUs.
Yeah, but my IBU heavy is my Russian Imperial Stout.
Yes.
Nah, there we go.
I actually tried to explain
that. That involves actual beer knowledge, by the way. And I don't think most people at a beer festival go that far.
No, not really.
But, and you know, like you said, part of the problem is a lot of festivals have become just excuses to go and get drunk, and now more festivals are starting up that are focused on like one style or very invitational only, and it's really and smaller, so you get a chance to meet brewers and talk to brewers and sample beer and expand your palate as a beer drinker.
And there's a purpose to it. There's a focus to it.
Yes.
And even here, just in Charlotte, North Carolina, we have Black and Blue, which is a big, very limited ticket sale, high-end beer. Everybody brings out the best. You have breweries that come from overseas to participate in. Salude holds a Sour Fest every year, and it's nothing but sours, which is a nightmare for anybody with acid reflux. But you can get some top-notch sours from across the world, and more than that, you get a chance to expand your palate with regards to that style and compare and contrast a little across the breadth of that style as well.
And I'm happy that that's how festivals are going, because if I ever started a festival, I've already thought about it. It would be probably like either a saison or a wheat festival that would happen at the beginning of summer or late spring, and it would just be focused on just one or two of those styles. And
it's just one tent serving nothing but Blue Moon.
But and my next article is called Hazy Days and Bright Futures.
I feel like I shook you a little bit with that, man.
My next article, Hazy Days and Bright Futures by Andy Crouch, one of my favorite beer writers, is also in the Beer Advocate. And this is not so much an attack on hazy IPAs as much as a critique on the movement around hazy IPAs, I think.
But the haze, bro.
Yeah. And that's kind of what he goes in on. And his basic argument is the focus and the complete ubiquity of hazy IPAs in the current craft beer world is starting to stifle the creativity and freedom of the brewers, because you gotta have a hazy IPA.
Way to go, New England.
Yeah, exactly.
Gave us the Patriots and you gave us hazy IPAs. What's next?
And part of his argument that I like the best is, because it's a kind of a subtle argument, is a lot of brewers, it's not just a problem that a lot of brewers are making hazy IPAs, but a lot of brewers don't have the skill or creativity to really explore the depth and breadth of what you can do with a hazy IPA. So everybody's just pumping out the same hazy, turbid beer. And it's not good for the long-term future of craft beer. At least that's his argument.
And there's definitely a right and a wrong way to do a hazy IPA.
100%. Yeah. And I do think it's important for people to keep that in mind, too, because you do see a lot of brewers these days. And I get why a lot of brewers hate making hazy IPAs. And Carly, definitely jump in on this as the resident brewer of the group.
I'm trying not to be too much of a hater on the hazy IPA train.
And it's kind of, there's a powerful force within brewing, because it goes against everything you were taught about how to brew, especially IPAs.
And so much research and time has gone into figuring out how to do it, like how to clarify beer and how to clarify it well and how to do it without losing a lot of the aroma and flavor of the hops.
But that haze, bro.
But that haze. I mean, I get why it became a thing. It's just it's a cool looking. Cool. It's a cool looking beer. It, you know, shows up great in photographs and Instagram.
Yeah.
but it's definitely, I think it goes against like every fiber of my being as a brewer.
Well, especially when you got places that are literally just dumping sacks of flour into the brew kettle. Yeah, that's a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
And I actually had a rep from a brewery who was selling me a hazy IPA say they did that. And I was like,
no, you don't lead with that.
Don't tell me that. I don't need to know that information.
That's like a, like oh my God. Whoa.
Yeah, I exactly. really wish you guys at home could see Carly's face right now. like she looks seriously disturbed. So far, we've managed to seriously bother both Ryan and Carly. We're off to an excellent start here.
I bet their brewer would be so pissed that they told you that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, that is something. That's a dark, dirty little secret.
That is a dark secret that, you know, is like punishable by death if you, like, are out.
Listen,
and
it said all
that.
Purpose flour. That means it's good for all purposes, Carly.
All purposes.
God, hater.
Oh, goodness.
And it's one of those things I do think there's. So we talked a little bit about this, Ryan, you and I, and a little while ago before we even. You know, started the show when Garrett Oliver was saying a lot of the same things about the style and was really getting going. And I want to preface this by saying that Garrett Oliver, if you can only ever reference or refer or respect one man in beer, he's really kind of the one to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was making a lot of these same comments, and it's really the one time I felt like there was kind of an element of like old men, you know, yelling at clouds kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I do think there is a generational divide.
There
around
definitely
hazy
is.
IPAs, yeah.
And again, it's like anything. There's a good and bad way to do it. Just like back in the mid to late 2000s, you had everybody throwing as many high alpha hops as you could into the boil and just, you know, how high can we push those IBUs, bro?
Yeah.
IBUs, bro. And now it's that haze, bro. And there's always going to be some element. If there's anything that you can do well, there's going to be people doing it poorly. Mm-hmm. I think it's Sturgeon's Law is the term for that. So, yeah, it's just a matter of do your research, and it's great to support local breweries. It's great to support any craft brewery, but you still, if they're making bad beer, you don't have to drink it. I know this will blow the minds of some people, but it's all right not to buy a second pint of a bad beer.
Yes. Yeah. That is something that I think as a beer market matures, the people in that market start to understand that. And I think Charlotte, as an example, has been a market that's had that problem. Where people have assumed that because it's local, it must be good. And that's really not the case at all.
Yeah, and even just within our city, there was a popular beer writer in the city who wrote a whole article about the fact that you shouldn't give bad breweries, or more specifically, a bad beer, the benefit of the doubt just because they're local. When you got a brand new brewery, now obviously you need to give them a little time to figure out their system. They should be hiring somebody who has experience, or at least they should be spending some time getting the system right to start with. But you can't keep these places afloat, and we're starting to see a lot of those elements. And I'll get into this here in a minute with a couple of things I wanted to cover, just about how craft beer is really priming up to be a victim of its own success.
Yeah.
And anything that we can do to keep that from happening and turn this into a learning and a growing experience is going to be good for everybody.
Yeah.
So kind of transitioning into that, a couple quick notes on things going on in the beer industry on my end. Deep Elm out in Texas, rather, third largest craft brewery in Texas, they recently received a pretty large influx of money from an outside investor. Investment group, you're seeing that happen more and more on the craft side. This investor was originally set up to take over 56% stake in the brewery and really kind of become the majority shareholder, kind of take it over and transition it into its next phase. They bought in for an initial investment of something like 23% because it was always supposed to go in kind of a step-by-step increase and incremental increase in that investment. Well, they've been paying attention to the trends like I feel like a lot of craft brewers haven't been, and they decided that they were going to stick with that 23% and just kind of hang out. And it provided the influx of capital for the we're having photographs taken of us. It really kind of creeped me out there for a second. Don't worry, we know who it is. This isn't some sort of weird Dateline thing. Yeah.
I was like, I don't know who it is.
I
hope you guys do.
So that influx of capital is supposed to give them kind of the option to buy up all the minority investors, transition on over this big investment group. Now the owner's sitting there, he's bought out all the minority investors, but he's still holding on to the largest stake. And he's complaining, he's upset, and I don't frankly think he has any right to be.
No.
If you're going with an investment group, their job and their entire purpose as an organization is to find good investments to make the money.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me like he kind of wanted to cash in and get out. And if they looked at the data, realized that you're probably not going to be growing at that same rate because you're a mid-range brewery in a fairly non-developed craft market like Texas, I think they made the right decision for themselves. And
yeah.
He's upset about it, but you got to adapt. That's the nature of the industry, and you got to focus on next steps for yourself. Take what capital you have left and, you know, reinvest that properly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right that he probably miscalculated what the capital investment group had in mind, and he probably thought, well, they're just going to invest in craft beer, and it turns out they're investing in a business sector that they mm-hmm. expect a certain return on investment over a certain amount of time, and if that doesn't happen, they're going to pull out because they're there to make money. They're not there to make beer.
And in 2017, we saw craft beer growth drop below 5% total market share growth or total dollar growth for the first time in, what, 6-7 years?
Yeah.
And it's definitely been a bit of a shakeup in the industry. And we talked a little bit about the fact that we don't necessarily see this as being a bad thing for the industry. It's not a collapse of the industry. It's just a flattening.
Yeah.
And you're going to see a lot of these breweries who may not be the best equipped to survive, they might wind up closing down. And that's extremely unfortunate. It's unfortunate for themselves. It's unfortunate for their employees, the people who depend on, people enjoy their beer. But at the end of the day, the reason this podcast exists is because beer is still business. And you still have to be able to survive in that business. And the fact that you just happen to be a craft brewery does not give you a right to survive.
Yep.
Yeah.
Kind of tying into that as well, the hop saturation that we got going on right now. I know we've touched on briefly on previous episodes. There are way too many damn hops right now. Yeah, so the Hop Growers of America, which is a nonprofit group that represents kind of the hop industry in the U.S., which is largely focused up in the Yakima Valley in Washington, they have essentially released findings that there's just, again, way too many damn hops. So essentially what happened was during that big growth period, all the smaller craft brewers, they started getting really into aroma hops. So to give you an idea, that's Amarillo, things like El Dorado, and some of those are even dual purpose, but a lot of those ones that are very high on the essential oils, they smell great. You get a lot of those big citrus flavor or citrus notes right on the nose. They overestimated how much they were going to need. And when that first slowdown hit, you had a lot of these breweries who were stuck in contracts, and anything other than a growth industry never would have been smart in the first place. It's essentially a Ponzi scheme. If craft beer doesn't keep growing, none of these contracts make sense. Mm-hmm. So now these hop farmers are sitting there holding on to all of these hops that they can't even sell for 75% of market value. A lot of them are being incredibly stubborn on renegotiating contracts in the first place. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of breweries who are literally going bankrupt trying to pay off the debt that they own on a lot of these. There's no cancellation fees. There's so many hops that are just out there sitting, starting to smell like foot cheese in various warehouses.
Literally, they're starting to smell like foot cheese.
Literally, that's what happens to old hops if you leave them sitting. They start smelling like cheese, which sounds incredibly appealing in beer. And there's not really a solution in mind. Already one of the big hop magnates, 47 Hops, out in Yakima, has had to go ahead and declare Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which is a bad sign for them. It's a good sign for craft beer drinkers in a lot of ways. It means that there's going to be a lot of hops that are likely going to flood the market, a lot of high-in-demand aroma hops that are going to hit the market and hit them at cheap prices. So you're going to see a ton more Mosaic, Amarillo, El Dorado, Citra making its way into your beer. But it's definitely a sign that the industry itself needs to stop shooting itself in the foot and assuming growth rather than earning growth.
Yeah, I think that's the sign of a maturing business sector, is that when we first started out, it was, we expect to have this growth. And in any mature business sector, a business person knows that kind of growth is
unsustainable.
It's abnormal and unsustainable.
Yeah, you saw people when it first dropped below 10% were freaking out. It's the end of the world. There are most industries would be overjoyed at a 6% increase like we saw in 2016. So don't get me wrong. Even though craft beer is growing, I think it was 3.7% growth last year, that's not a bad thing. That's still very much a positive growth. The slowdown should be concerning, but we should be looking for the reasons for that and not panicking about all craft beer itself starting to collapse out from under us.
Yes.
Speaking again of the, you know, growth issues within the craft beer industry, Craft Beer Alliance, which for those of you who aren't really read up on the various conglomerates that kind of control some of that top level and mid level of craft beer. Craft Beer Alliance is a group that owns Red Hook Brewing. They own Widmer Brothers Brewing. They own Kona Brewing, which you'll see in grocery stores near you. They own Emission Brewing, which is a gluten-free beer brand. They're also 32% owned by Anheuser-Busch. See, the conspiracy continues.
We need to get like the Darth Vader theme to add in at post at some point whenever we get to this story.
We can make that happen. Yeah, because here's George Lucas doesn't have any money to sue us with. So they wound up just getting rid of their emergent business department, which was essentially the branch of their business that made investments in other breweries. For example, they have 25% stake in Appalachian Mountain Brewing right here in the greater Charlotte region, up in Boone. Yeah, rough greater Charlotte. Don't give me that look, Ryan. Like,
yeah, okay.
All North Carolina is greater Charlotte. I'm gonna get
don't
so
tell anyone from Raleigh
from
that.
Raleigh. Oh, man, I'll be shanked by somebody from Nashville. So they own a 25% stake in them, a 25% stake in Cisco up in Nantucket, Massachusetts. So they definitely have been investing around. Those just haven't paid the dividends they're looking for. And honestly, the brands that CBA owns outright, like Red Hook, like Widmer Brothers, have been an absolute free fall. They've been seeing the 10-plus percentage point drops in sales on a yearly basis for 3 or 4 years.
Those are a lot of the, like, regional legacy brewers that are still around. They've been around for pretty much since the start of craft brewing in
mid-sized
the 90s.
Mid-sized grocery store breweries. Red Hook was one of the first breweries I drank extensively.
Yeah, and me too.
Part of me is upset to see them collapsing so hard, but by the same token, the beer's not that great. Their branding is terrible. They haven't marketed themselves to a industry that is changing literally by the day.
Yeah.
And when you're basically becoming grocery store filler for other companies that have controlling stakes, I think that it's about your time to about your time to close up shop. The only real brand that they have that's really still doing well has been Kona, which has been growing well, and they've literally even decided to refocus their efforts. They call it Kona Plus strategy, and just every effort they have is being poured into Kona, just trying to keep the other brands afloat, and it's really not been working at all.
Like you said, a lot of, like Red Hook, the beer is not great. It's not bad beer, but it's just there's nothing special about it.
Boring.
You can find a beer as good as something from Red Hook from a local craft brewery, and you would be supporting a local craft brewery instead of Red Hook.
Yeah, and if there was anything that I could like drive into people, I mean, we're nowhere near Black Friday right now, but this enters my mind every time I see people who talk trash about ABI year round and never stop. And the moment Bourbon County gets released by Goose Island, all of a sudden their morals and ethics get tossed right out the window. Here's the thing. Like, it's not that these breweries are making bad beer. Wicked Weed is still making some fantastic beer. Yeah. Elysian makes some very good IPAs. 10 Barrel makes some very good beer. But there are places, whether near you or just happen to be independent, that are making beer that's every bit as good, probably around the same time of year that you can get for around the same price.
Maybe cheaper.
Way less headaches, not standing in line for 4 hours. So why are you compromising what you say you believe in to get this beer? There's 6,000 breweries, guys. You got options.
Yeah.
You got so many options. So please just take the time and think about that before you start patronizing some of these larger breweries that are held by these international interests. Last but not least, at least as far as brew news is concerned, Massachusetts General Assembly, they've been going through all sorts of headaches trying to get their beverage legislation straightened out. They hadn't really revisited any of their blue laws or any of their beverage control laws since Prohibition ended, which is a story you'll kind of see echoed across a lot of states. You have a lot of these rules, a lot of these laws were written into stone when Prohibition ended to try and keep the abuses that were happening prior to Prohibition from reoccurring. Most of them have not only backfired terribly, they've been absolute disasters. They're terribly out of date at best. So a lot of states are finally starting to realize that with craft beer growing the way it is, craft distilling starting to take off, craft wine really starting to get going. It's in their best interest to try and revisit some of these. Well, there's a bill on the table with the Massachusetts General Assembly to make it so that it's the Merging Breweries Bill, I think is what it was called.
Yeah, I think that's
It was essentially set up so that breweries under 30,000 barrels a year could break up with their wholesaler distributors at any time for any reason, as long as they paid basically fair market price for the shares and the inventory that was left.
Wow.
Yeah, which would be a pretty big and considerable step. And the argument from the wholesalers was that this would effectively gut them. But if you're a wholesaler and you're that heavily leveraged on a brewery that is under 30,000 barrels a year, you're probably not a very good distributor to start with.
You have a bad business plan to begin with.
Yeah.
You should go out of business.
Yeah, exactly. So it wound up getting shot down in the House, which was tough to see. A lot of the small breweries have really been gaining steam in New England. That was really one of the areas of the country. It was kind of the last to really get going on craft beer, partially because of craft beer, because Harpoon, because Boston Beer Company were so strong for so long that it's a shame to see that get shot down and then have to kind of go to square one, rebuild that back up.
I mean, one of the things you will find if you study, if you just like read about any of the changes to liquor and alcohol laws in any state, you will find that the wholesalers in every state are probably one of the two or three most powerful political action committees in each state, because they have their finger, they have their tentacles in every
tentacles.
Tentacles is a good description.
Yeah, we already established on a previous episode that brewers are cats. We're now establishing that wholesalers are octopi.
Exactly.
Octopuses?
They have their tentacles in every county around octopi. Yeah,
octopi.
Octopi is the plural of octopus.
Squids.
They have their tentacles in every county in every state, and every politician has to deal with. Has to get money, and wholesalers, their local wholesalers, are a good place to get campaign contributions. And even in North Carolina, where one of the most powerful politicians in the state legislature, is also one of the owners of one of the largest wholesalers in the state.
Wait. Ryan, are you trying to tell me that money affects American politics? Because I am having a real hard time believing that.
I hate to break it to you, but money does affect American politics. And as the Supreme Court said, that money is free speech, apparently, in politics, which
I don't know, because I talk an awful lot and I don't have a lot of money. So one of these things just doesn't sync up.
But yeah, that's one of the things that I've noticed, because I've like, as part of the reason we're doing this podcast is we both like this stuff just in general. So I've like read a lot about each state and how they're changing their alcohol laws, and that's a recurring theme, is the wholesalers have an iron grip on how alcohol laws were written. Like in Georgia, basically the wholesalers wrote the law that got passed that they ended up basically having to repeal, because it was supposed to help craft brewers, but somehow it ended up screwing craft brewers worse.
That would be like my Viking ass writing the law about how minimum length your beard can be. Like, that makes zero sense.
Exactly.
Excellent.
And I will say that one last thing is the one state that's done a good job on changing their alcohol laws is the state of New York. They spent, I think, at least a year studying how to change all their laws from craft brewers.
Modernizing them.
Yeah, they modernized all their laws for brewers, winemakers, distillers, and everyone. And it's it's been in effect for like a year now.
You've seen a huge explosion of new craft breweries throughout the state, and even some of the existing ones have really started to just get more creative, expand, push the product to new places. Yeah. We just recently got Captain Lawrence Brewing down here in North Carolina, which if you guys ever get a chance to try any of their beer,
they're fantastic.
They're Pilsner. Just speaking about a fizzy yellow beer is one of the best ones I've had nationwide.
Yeah.
So definitely worth checking out. But speaking about beer, I hear, getting off the dollars and cents. Hey, Carly.
Hey.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Doing fantastic. So tell us a little bit about your story. So you're now the head brewer over at Bold Missy right here in Charlotte, North Carolina. Where did you come from?
I just moved out here from San Diego, California.
Ah, short move.
Just real quick pop over. I started in the craft beer industry at 16. I was a hostess at a brew pub in San Diego.
I was about to say, if you started as a brewer at 16, that's a pretty good hustle.
You know, it's been about 12 years. So I was a hostess. I went to school and got my degree in accounting and finance at the University of San Diego. And I was just kind of working through college. And our brewer was in between assistants. And he needed somebody to, schlep spent grain around, schlep unmalted grain around, or unmilled grain around.
Go for work.
Yeah, yeah. I was a gopher.
It's always nice to find someone young and dumb who's willing to do that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And it was kind of, and I was at Gordon Biersch Brewery in San Diego. And at the time, they were still doing the whole kind of step mash, you know, huge long mash program. So it was also kind of just someone to like hang out and not be alone in the brewery all day. So I was doing that.
You got hired to keep him company?
I mean, I wouldn't say that exactly. I did move spec
grade around. I did hired to move heavy things and keep him company. He sounds like a great boss.
I also brought donuts.
Oh, wow. I noticed you didn't bring us donuts here today, Carly.
I asked what I was supposed to bring, and all I was told to bring was water.
I said bring your usual positive attitude. I assume that meant donuts. Okay.
Next time I'll know. So
if
I was.
There isn't next time.
I mean, maybe not. But so I was with him kind of unofficially for about 6 months until I finished school. When I finished school, I remember we were at the San Diego Brewers Guild, San Diego Beer Week Guild Festival. And I was talking to, I had been working with long enough that a bunch of people knew who I was. And everybody kept asking me like, oh, Carly, like, you know, what do you want to do in beer? Like, what are you going to do next? Like, are you going to do this? And he would keep on interjecting and just be like, oh, no. She's going to be an accountant. She's about to graduate. She's going to be a CPA. I'm like, so I finally pulled him aside and was like, Doug, I don't want to be a CPA. Like, if I can continue to brew beer and like make a job out of this, like, I would really like to do that. He was like, oh, okay. I had no idea. So then in December, I became, after I graduated school, my schedule opened up, became officially his assistant. I was his assistant for about 10 months until there was an opening with Rock Bottom in San Diego, because Gordon Biersch and Rock Bottom are owned by the same kind of investment group. And so there was an opening at the other location, and when I left Gordon Biersch, they were still only doing German-style beers, staying very closely to Reinheitsgebot.
Which is not a necessarily bad thing, but no. It does limit your overall ability to learn as a young brewer quite a bit.
Yeah, and we were also on a very large system. So the first system that I ever brewed on was a 25-barrel system with 50-barrel fermenters. So we were brewing like at most once a week. Most of the time it was like once every other week. And then moving to Rock Bottom, it was going to be a much smaller system with more fermenters. It was an 8-barrel system with 6 16-barrel fermenters. So it was kind of a move just to get a different experience, learn about ales.
And a lot of people who don't have a ton of experience in the industry, they know Rock Bottom as being a franchise chain. What they don't realize is the level of autonomy and the number of, I guess, the amount of freedom that the individual locations have to come up with their own brews and really kind of tailor them to their particular audience.
Yeah. And so with Gordon Biersch, they were still sticking to their core recipes that you weren't allowed to do any changes with. Brewers with Gordon Biersch were able to do one brewer select beer a year. They've since changed, and now they get to do a lot more different beers. But at the time, there wasn't that type of freedom, so I was going to learn a lot more about recipe development. Yeah. The brewer that was at the other location, he has done the UC Davis Extension Master Brewers Program. So I was definitely going to learn a lot from him from that. So
kind of a big deal.
So I definitely kind of made that move. I was the assistant brewer for Rock Bottom for about a year and a half until my boss left to open up his own brewery, Second Chance Beer Company in San Diego. And Marty Maniola was the brewer at Rock Bottom. He's won, like, I can't even count how many, like, gold, silver, bronze, GABF, and World Beer Cup. Like, he's a very well-decorated brewer.
I feel like I might have heard of those.
Yeah, you know, they're kind of like a big deal.
Kind of a big deal. All right, we definitely have the title of this episode. Kind of a big deal is definitely the title of this episode.
So when he left, they promoted me. And at that time, Rock Bottom had switched to the beer list was basically built up of a light, usually a Kolsch style beer. Fizzy yellow beer. A malty option, a hoppy option, a rotating dark, and a rotating wheat option. But within those styles, the brewers could do whatever they wanted. Yeah. And then I had a 12 tap. I had three 10-tap towers that I could do 12 different beers on. So I was able to do outside of those five styles, I had seven other taps that I could play around with. And I had six fermenters and eight serving vessels, which was awesome.
And that's an incredible amount of like space for innovation. Yeah. There's a lot of completely independent breweries who have nowhere near that just sheer freedom and ability to play around.
Yeah. And I took over at 25, and that was a little scary.
Kind of a big deal.
But so it was like kind of scary, but also really exciting at the same time, because I was able to just take all of the kind of the backing that I and support that I got from Rock Bottom and really explore a lot of different beer styles that I probably wouldn't have been able to do with a small startup brewery, because just the capital is not there to buy certain hops, to buy certain malts, to just try stuff. My pilot batch size was 8 barrels.
For reference for people at home, that's not a pilot batch. That's a
16
batch.
Kegs. Yes. because I also, so yeah, I started 25 barrels, 8 barrel system, and then I was bought a homebrew kit for my birthday 1 year. And so I've homebrewed, I think, 4 times, and only one time it made it into bottles.
Which that is absolutely unheard of for brewers. So many brewers got their start as homebrewers, and even the ones who might have gone directly into production brewing, I mean, that's basically how you do your homework and cut your teeth.
Yeah.
You might be the only brewer I've ever run into who's not only never homebrewed, you were telling me you've never homebrewed successfully, which is hilarious and gives me nothing but confidence in you.
Yeah, I did get one made into the bottles. It was one that I did with my dad, and we did it on like around Father's Day. It was really cute, but it like definitely came out. We did it in amber because that's his favorite style, and it definitely came out, and I'm like, oh God, Dad, there's so much diastole in here.
No, I like it. Like, it's caramelly.
No, it's great. It's great. I love it. Like, we did it together, and I'm just like, oh, okay, Dad, you can do this. Don't give it to any of your friends. Don't let anybody else drink it. I think that it's definitely a unique portion of my kind of brewing experience that I don't have this kind of hang up of trying to scale up recipes. I'm never trying to scale up recipes. I'm always kind of thinking on that large production scale. Like, how am I going to like make this so that it's, you know, cost effective? How am I going to make this to where it's actually going to be an efficient, palatable, balanced, good beer on a large scale versus kind of like, okay, well, this turned out really, really great when I made it in a 5-gallon system. Oh, I can do this. I can make 50 barrels of this.
Half of it was black start molasses. That shouldn't be a problem to replace. And I think that's one thing that a lot of people just don't realize is it's not a simple matter going from home brewing up to a production brewery of just
really
scaling
rough.
Things up. They're in a lot of the base principles are identical, but the process is entirely different. And that's one of the reasons you see so many people go from home brewing to owning a brewery. It takes them about 6 months to figure out their own system.
Yep. So I was with Rock Bottom as the head brewer for about 3 years. And then I was able to... I trained 2 assistants while I was there. One left me to go work for my old boss at Second Chance Beer Company. And then the last one I had there, I was able to train him to take over for me, which I think is another really great kind of facet of Rock Bottom is we are very apt to promoting within and training from within. I started as a hostess, and like then I became a head brewer. Like,
isn't that how most people get into beer?
Yeah, I mean, duh. And so I really like that portion of it. And then Carol over at our owner over at Bold Missy, she kind of contacted me through the Pink Boot Society. And
tell us a little about what the Pink Boot Society is. This will definitely be coming up on future shows, guys.
Yes.
So take notes.
So the Pink Boot Society is a society of women in beer, not women in craft beer, not women brewers, women in the general beer industry. So whether you are a brewer, work in production, work in tasting rooms, work in distribution, work in legal, work in accounting. We want to just support women in the beer industry. And we do that with scholarships and networking and events and different types of things like that.
And I can't understate how important that organization is. And in no way are you necessarily the official spokesperson for Pink Boot Society, but in a lot of ways, any woman in the brewing industry has to be a spokesperson for the Pink Boots, because it is so important to have that level of representation. And just a little shout out to the future. We will be having a representative of the Pink Boot Society on a future show to speak a little more in depth on that, especially with us coming up to their annual Beer to Femme Beer Festival right here in North Carolina.
Yeah. I was our chapter president or chapter leader in San Diego. So like I know a good amount on it, but it's definitely, it's a really great organization that has done a lot for women in brewing, and it not even just like, you know, women it, like becoming brewers or like doing anything, but just kind of the general getting people to understand that there are women that work in the beer industry and it is not just a boys club.
And that shouldn't be exceptional.
And
that,
you don't
that
have to have a beer to brew.
Not with that attitude. I believe in you. If you really put some focus into it, Carly, we can make that happen. And so linking up with Bold Missy, tying into that, for people who don't know that, they're the second all-female owned and operated brewery in the state of North Carolina. And for a lot of people, I don't think they realize how unfortunately rare that is even now, and how important it is to be able to foster those breweries and patronize them and make sure that you get out and support what they're doing out there.
I think it's actually super awesome the amount of female brewers, women-owned breweries that are in North Carolina. Coming from San Diego, where there was, I think we're at almost, if not surpassing, 160 breweries in the county of San Diego. Just the county of San Diego. And I can count on one, at the time when I was still there, I could count on one hand how many female brewers or female brewery owners there were. And I think there's like four or five in Charlotte alone, not even counting what in up in Asheville.
We do have a lot of husband and wife teams in North Carolina who own breweries. With the and you know, you do see some of those where it's a husband wife team and only one partner really is taking the leading role. A lot of these are absolute partnerships. For example, Susie and Todd Ford over at Noda Brewing. Susie's fantastic. And you take a look at even just the female brewers in the state. Holly, who is over at Highland Brewing, she's now with Diageo. As a matter of fact, Highland Brewing is their president is a
Leah
woman.
Wong.
Yeah, Leah Wong, which is absolutely fantastic. It's definitely been nice to see how some of these craft beer markets that are kind of late to the game on getting to craft beer, ironically, have been the ones that have had the least. Yeah, they've had kind of the least, I guess, brambles to clear out of the way and a fewest obstacles.
Yeah.
Towards reaching a more progressive, egalitarian point in the industry.
Yeah.
So tell us a little about your time so far at Bold Missy and how that's been and what you guys are kind of doing over there.
So far it's been great. The system's
don't worry,
awesome.
You're not being recorded. This is all off the record.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Off the record.
Dish.
It's been really great. We've got a great space. It's huge, huge space that we have a lot of room for expansion. Right now we have a 15-barrel system with 4 15-barrel fermenters and 4 15-barrel bright tanks. So it's been able to pump out a lot of beer. We can't really decide on what wording verbiage we're using for this, but basically kind of revamped a lot of the core beer styles.
Refining,
that's a good word. I like that.
You probably got a marketing background.
So we've got like our core beers. We have Get Your Gun Golden, which is kind of a traditional golden style. It's our fizzy yellow beer. We've got Find a Way Wheat, which is a tangerine Belgian wit beer. Which
that is going to be my beer of the summer. That is freaking fantastic.
Yeah, so that one has definitely had a lot of really big changes to it. The brew before me was using tangerine extract, which when you're brewing on large scale, and that is your, you know, it's just, it's a, kind of an easy way to do things. It's definitely, I can't stand the taste of extract and anything.
Yes, that is a peeve of mine.
It's absolutely the worst to me. I remember when I came to visit Charlotte before I took the job at Bold, before I even knew there was an opening at Bold Missy, and I went into the brewery and I kind of, because I wanted to check it out, and that was the one that I tasted it. I was just like, oh my goodness, it's a tangerine jelly bean. So I've definitely switched that one into being all natural, tangerine, aspect.
Wait, you don't work for Jelly Belly?
I don't work for Jelly Belly. No.
Well, this interview is way different than I thought it was
going to
be.
So we've been doing, I switched it up to having tangerine peel in the kettle on the hot side, and then on the cold side after fermentation has almost completely finished. We've got a tangerine puree from Oregon Fruit Products that I've been using that is really kind of rounding out the flavor, but keeping it very natural and not chemical extracty. Then after that, we have our Rocket Ride, which is a traditional American style IPA, kind of modeled after Bell's Two Hearted. And that's I switched the hops around on that one, kind of cleaned up the malt bill a little bit, switched it to a Centennial and Chinook hopping, which is more traditional, good for the kind of little caramel notes in the malt backbone. And then another one that I did a big change on was the Solo Flight Brown Ale. I changed it from an American Brown Ale to an English style Brown Ale.
Oh, it all ties together.
It all ties together. I know. When we were talking about American and English porters this earlier, I was like, ooh. I am a big, big, I love brown ales. Brown ales are my absolute favorite style of beer. And so when I came on, when I was interviewing with them, one thing that I told them, I was just like, so one thing that's going to have to change is that there is not going to be an American style brown ale. Like if I have been, I have been refining my English style brown ale recipe for the last 3 years. It's
kind of
gone,
a big deal.
Yeah, it is my baby. And so that was one of the things that I was like, okay, but I can't brew an American style brown ale. Like if that's part of the stipulation of me taking this job, I'm going to have to say no. So it was. So we've changed that from an American style to an English style brown ale, a little bit more maltier, not quite so bitter. One of my favorite malts that came onto the market last year or the year before is Simpson's Double Roasted Crystal, which gives really great color into the beer with keeping it super light, not a lot of like coffee roasted characteristics, more of a date raisin characteristic, and then some good old naked oats and that kind of stuff. So that's been nice.
Well, it was lovely of you to bring us in a sample of that beer alongside the donuts.
I wasn't sure if I was supposed to bring beer or not. That's why I asked.
Yeah, we're not even really sure what the rules are in the podcast studio.
Exactly. So I was like, I don't want to, just assume. But then other things, those are the changes on the core beers, stuff that I've brought in that's new. We just released, or not just released, but we released last month our Surfstar West Coast IPA coming from San Diego. That definitely was going to be my first beer that I put out in Charlotte. And then
bring a little West Coast with you.
Yeah, bring some West Coast with me. Give me some feelings of home. And then I also
already.
I definitely don't think that I could like go back to San Diego without brewing, like having already brewed a West Coast beer here.
You had to bring a little piece of that over. Yeah. That was your gift to us. So nice of you to bless us with that.
I mean, I tried.
Good looking out.
I just like everybody back home would be like, what do you mean you haven't made a West Coast IPA yet? Like, why did they bring you out there? Like, why did you leave us? Every day I get texts from friends in the industry back home like, so are you tired of it yet? Are you coming back yet? I'm like, no, guys, like I moved. And then
my mom asks me the same thing all the time. Yeah. When are you moving back home?
Yeah.
Never, mom.
Yep. See, my parents are taking the other route and they're looking at houses up here.
Oh, yeah, that's lovely. Yeah.
I'm okay with it. I love my parents, but it's just so funny. Because
Breaking news, guys. Carly loves her parents.
But I have two brothers that live on the West
Coast.
I have two brothers that live on the West Coast, and they're like, oh, you just moved? Yeah, we'll move too. I'm like, I told you I'm the favorite child. they always say, like, no, you're the favorite daughter because I have two brothers. I'm like, no, I'm the favorite child.
Statement has been made.
Yeah.
You're moving cross-country for your one kid. Statements have been made.
Yeah. And so just on Friday, I was pretty excited because I got informed on yesterday morning that we had set a record for our Friday sales when we released our Trapper Keeper pink peppercorn lemon saison with glitter.
That sounds so damn good.
Yeah, it's pretty tasty.
So weird and so damn good.
Yeah. And so it was really awesome to see that people have really been embracing the new beers that I've brought on and all of that, which has been great because, it's definitely coming into somewhere there where they were kind of established, not super established yet because they just opened last May, but coming in and
that first impression had already been made. And for you to come in and be able to kind of earn a second first impression and create those waves all over again, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, so that was great. And then coming out, we've got, I just brewed a Belgian triple. And then, you know, just we're going to do an Irish amber releasing in March.
I hear there might be an Irish holiday coming up in March.
Yeah, you know, there's like a thing.
Patrick? I don't know. Something like that.
Patty.
You know, yeah, something about clovers or something.
Yeah.
Cloverfield? Yeah. So circling a little back to the Surf Star.
Yes.
Bringing a West Coast IPA to the East Coast, have you noticed any just distinct differences? And I know your experience on the East Coast brewing scene has been fairly limited so far, but just any initial impressions on some big differences between a well-developed, extremely mature beer scene like San Diego and a fairly young, relatively unmature beer scene like you have here in Charlotte?
I think the biggest difference that I've noticed is kind of... It's the maturity of the industry. It's the maturity of the craft beer drinkers. As a craft beer drinker, you go through these phases when you start into craft beer. Like you start, you know, so many people were started on Blue Moon, and then they go through all of the wheat beer tastings, and then, you know, they get over that, and then they move into the maltier and darker styles. Then after that, they kind of go into, you know, once they've gotten over the dark beers and the bitterness of the dark beers, then they move into the IPAs. After that, you kind of go into the more funky categories, saisons, farmhouse styles. It's kind of a natural progression. So I've noticed that there are, you know, big bulk of the market is, you know, after certain styles of beer right now. A lot of beers that I would see being really popular back in San Diego aren't as popular over here. But that kind of thing.
How about festivals? We were talking about kind of the changing face of festivals. And as a part of the country has been doing beer festivals before you could likely even get a permit for one in this part of the country.
Yep. I was kind of excited to come to somewhere where it wasn't so festival heavy. Like in San Diego, there on average is... between 2 and 3 beer festivals a weekend.
Oh my god!
And so
take me.
So there's a lot in there. I'm friends with a lot of people that organize beer festivals back there, and they're trying to kind of figure out the best way to do it. And there's been so much. It's kind of the same type of transparency we want to see with big beer and craft beer. It's the same thing with certain beer festivals, because in California, in order to hold a beer festival, you have to pull a 501c3 license permit.
Yeah.
So all of them are connected with a charity, but certain ones that have a management company take some of the money, and some of the money goes to charity. So certain ones have a good amount of going to charity, and some of them have a very small portion going to charity. So it's really hard as for the breweries also, because they're asking for us to donate beer, because we have to donate the beer.
And donate your time as well.
And donating the depending on the brand. The type of beer festival that it is, it either has to be a donation. Sometimes they buy the beer. But then they have to have certain licenses for that. And so our big thing for us is we want to know where the money is going from the ticket sales. Like, if we're donating our beer, our time.
Which seems perfectly reasonable.
Yeah.
If you're going to be giving them something, I think the only thing that you really need to ask back is, hey, we just want to make sure that our time, our energy, our brand equity is going to be going to the cause that you told us it was.
Yeah. So that's been a big thing that's been going on with beer festivals back in San Diego, because everybody's been, you know, there's too many. We can't just keep donating beer to all of these different beer festivals. And a lot of breweries have been dialing back the amount of beer festivals that they're doing. Instead of doing, you know, 30, 40 festivals a year, they're doing, you know, 15 to 20 festivals. They're picking and choosing the festivals that are going to give them the best exposure, that they're going, the money, the beer that they're donating is going to be doing the most help. And then we've been having kind of a backlash from the organizers of beer festivals. They're like, well, you donated beer to us last year. And it's like, okay, so.
You missed that one word,
donated. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think as you see a lot more breweries start to pull back and become more taproom focused, that trend's going to continue. Mm-hmm. It does you a lot less good to be advertising out in the market, even with something as organic as a beer festival, if really you're just trying to pull people in the taproom in the first place, which is really going to be your walk through traffic, your local neighborhood, local marketing.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, who really remembers every beer that they had at a beer festival? I barely remember any beer that I've ever had at a beer festival, including some of them I've worked.
Yeah. So. We've done kind of these trying to figure out our ROI on beer festivals. And
that's return on investment. Sorry, folks. Yeah.
My accounting
real
background.
Real technically.
We will have like kind of discount codes and coupon things that people can pick up and bring back into the brewery, the tasting room, the restaurant, and see how many people were actually pulling in from beer festivals. And it's extremely low. The amount of people that are actually coming in to your brewery that because they saw you at a beer festival.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've noticed here in Charlotte, when people go to like the QC Brewers Festival, it's a lot of those people already
go to those breweries.
So it's basically almost a closed system where you're just kind of recycling the same people over and over and over again.
Feedback loop.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and you've definitely seen that even here in the less developed market. And you even have, in the state of North Carolina, for example, you can have for-profit festivals. And we do have a decent number and a growing number, not nearly as much as sounds like the mecca that is San Diego. but we do have a fairly large number of beer festivals. Some of those are for profit, and a lot of those will even ask you to donate beer.
Yeah.
Listen, I get it. You guys are trying to make a buck, but at the end of the day, for these breweries, that's really kind of the equivalent of an artist donating art for exposure.
Yeah.
It never works in their favor.
No.
It's really just a way of getting something for nothing on behalf of those. I got a feeling you're going to see, like we were talking about with the article you brought in, Ryan, a more focused orientation around some of these beer festivals and the sheer quantity of them, and the ones that are dedicated pretty much entirely to just going, getting drunk, and forgetting what you did all day are going to start to fade away.
You don't want them to get too focused, though, too, because we have some beer festivals in San Diego. It's like Beer and Taco Fest, Beer and Clam Chowder Fest.
I swear to God, if you say a bad word about beer and tacos.
Oh, no. There is nothing bad about beer and tacos. But the thing with the festival is you go and there's beer and tacos, and the beer is included in your ticket price, but the tacos aren't.
Ooh, that's the trick.
Yeah.
That's
so nice. My friends back at home, they organized this Mission Valley Craft Beer Festival that has a bunch of restaurants that come. And so your ticket is all inclusive. So they do each restaurant that is participating do small bites. And then they also do a beer and bacon fest, which is favorite. And they have this, like, every restaurant comes and they have a bacon, ham, you know, pig product focused. There are even some
brought in trotters. All right, there you go.
There are even some beers that people brew with bacon in it.
I'll be honest, I have had bacon beers before, and they shouldn't work.
No. A lot of times they don't.
I have had pretty good experience with
them. There's some good ones. It depends on where you put the bacon in the process.
Ah, yes. That's don't just throw the whole pig in there right as you're boiling and hope for the best.
Yeah. So you want some type of focus, but you also want to make sure that it still makes sense, and it's still going to make sense for like years to come, and it makes sense for the breweries and
There's a reason that festivals started and why they became part of the industry in the first place. But again, like all good things, Sturgeon's Law, if you have enough of anything, there will be stupid versions of it.
Yep.
So. And it goes back to the industry is maturing, and that's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Things will change and shift over time, and the festivals won't be the same as they were. They won't be as important, and that's good.
And the biggest thing that the breweries can do on the side of making the festivals be better is to communicate with each other. Back in San Diego, we have kind of this Facebook group that our guild put together, and it's a closed group that are just for guild members, and we basically talk about like, hey, this person, we just had one thread right before I left of, you know, this person has been kind of trying to bully me into his beer festival. Has anybody else done this festival? Like, what kind of is going on? Like, he's basically kind of trying to bully me into doing this. And then everybody else kind of jumped on, is like, hey, he's doing the same thing to me and all of this stuff. And then those, as long as the breweries are communicating amongst each other and talking about, like, and even, like, taking notes, like, I would take notes back in San Diego of which festivals that I felt were productive for me, which festivals had really good organization, which festivals were really focused on the charities, and then, you know, remembering for next year, like, and not patronizing as a, like, you know, not using being a vendor for certain festivals that you don't feel are doing yourself or the public a service for craft beer.
And it is a cooperatively competitive industry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's 6,000 breweries, but it's still 6,000 against a handful of mega giants. And mm-hmm. it's a very tight-knit industry. Yes. From the brewers to the bar staff to the sales reps to the owners, they talk. And if we have anybody who deals with the beer industry from the outside that listens to this podcast, guys, mm-hmm. just keep in mind that pretty much anything that you say or do is not being communicated
just to the person you're talking to.
Yeah, just the person you're talking to, and not in a judgmental sense. No. It's just, it's like anything else where you have a large group of people who care about each other, want to see each other succeed, and they talk. Yeah. So if you do something untoward towards one of them, mm-hmm. if you screw over a brewery, if you are being pushy, bullying, anything like that, it's going to extend beyond just that individual or just mm-hmm. that one brewery. Yeah.
There's maybe 2 degrees of separation between anybody in any craft beer community between anybody else in that craft beer community.
In San Diego, there's been kind of our guild motto has always been a rising tide lifts all boats. San Diego became the kind of craft beer, or as in San Diego, I don't know if they've trademarked this, but the capital of craft. Is what they call it.
Ooh, that's a bold statement right there.
Hey, I left. It
was the first real mecca of craft beer, though, and a lot of people on the East Coast don't realize that.
Yeah, and I think it was able to be that way because everybody was so collaborative and so helpful, and so many breweries. I would probably say a good maybe 60-75% of the breweries were opened from brewers who worked for kind of what I call the big four in San Diego, which would be Stone, Green Flash, Ballast Point, and Carl Strauss.
Never heard of any of them. No. Probably some small local brands.
Super small local brands. But a lot of those brewers that started all of these kind of smaller breweries started from there. And they were able to open their own breweries because they learned from these larger breweries, and then they also helped them when they opened.
And what we sometimes lose sight of is that essentially craft beer was a local movement in the local hedge industry in California before mm-hmm. it spread anywhere, even to the rest of the West Coast, even to Colorado, mm-hmm. even to Vermont, even to Asheville. It really started in San Diego and San Francisco, were really kind of mm-hmm. those two early growth centers for it. It's interesting to use them as kind of a test case for future development of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, Ryan, got any recommendations for us today? Any beer recommendations, I guess, would be a good place to start.
Yes, my beer recommendation this week is the Deep River 4042 Stout. It is a really good sweet stout from Deep River Brewing here in North Carolina. It's, like, I think it's 5.3%. It's a good, easy drinking, not too sweet, a good balance of the sweetness of the lactose and the bitterness from the malt and hops, and it's just nice, easy to drink. And I've had a lot of that beer this week.
Mm-hmm. I thought you looked a little hungover coming in today. By last night, did you mean this morning? So I'm definitely going to recommend from English Ale Abbey in Austria. It's a Trappist brewery. It's only the second Trappist brewery located outside of Belgium, the first one being La Trappe. Their Gregorius Quad is just absolutely magnificent. It's like drinking raisin and prune juice, which sounds like the most disgusting thing ever, but I swear, you put a little bit of alcohol in that and it's absolutely fantastic. Excellent malt, good hints of toast, and just finishes off with enough of that sweetness, those nice yeasty qualities to really round out the beer as a whole. How about yourself, Carly? Going to put you on the spot just a little bit.
Well, I haven't had a ton of time to kind of get my forays into the Charlotte craft beer scene, so I don't have a standout favorite. I've been working real hard trying to get some of, our beer out there. But, kind of bringing something over from the West Coast that's been one of my favorite beers kind of got me hooked into craft beer and especially into brown ales. But the Alesmith Nut Brown, I don't know if does that get distributed out
here? We have Alesmith out here. Okay. It's not common, but we definitely
can. Okay, Alesmith Nut Brown is definitely one of my all-time favorite beers. It's pretty much when I was developing my brown recipe, I would go pop over to Alesmith, get a growler of theirs, bring it back, taste them side by side. It's my benchmark for the style. So,
excellent.
Nice.
So any other recommendations from you, Ryan?
Well, I have two articles that I read this week. One, Quincy Jones in conversation at vulture.com, and the other, Donald Glover has always been two steps ahead from Esquire.com. And part of it, first of all, the Quincy Jones interview is amazing and awesome because, honestly, he has seen everything, done everything. He's like 85, and he does not give a fuck anymore.
Yeah, I read a little bit about the article. He dives pretty deep on the issue of Michael Jackson, and boy, that he's got some things to say there.
And actually, my favorite part was him talking. Well, one of my favorite parts was him talking about the Beatles, and basically, he's like, "Yeah, Paul is the worst bassist I've ever heard in my life." And then, and he completely dismisses it. He's like, "Ringo," and you can kind of imagine in the interview him just like going Ringo and just waving his hands in the air like I there's nothing even to say about how bad a drummer Ringo is.
Oh man.
And then the
boy, we're really trying to piss people off. Yeah, we hate the Beatles.
Oh, the Beatles are the greatest band ever, but
except for the drummer,
Ringo played his part. You have John and you have Paul, and then you have George over here in the corner being cool and weird. And
then there was Ringo.
And then there's the class clown, Ringo. But, and the other thing I did like about the article is how he went at younger musicians who don't have any idea of like the history of music and how, where the music came from. And it kind of goes into something that Andy Crouch wrote about in the article I talked about at the beginning, is how the idea of for Quincy Jones, the idea of musicianship is being lost in music, because everyone's just so focused on getting music out there that is a top 40 hit and making a bunch of money. They don't care about making good product. They just want a good
music's
end
become
result.
An avenue to get rich and famous, exactly. Rather than being a goal in and of itself that happens to get you rich and famous.
So that's kind of it, tied back to some of the things I read with Andy Crouch, at least in my head. And the other article about Donald Glover is,
I love that man.
Yes. And the new season of Atlanta comes out March 1. And so he's starting to do the rounds and do his interviews. And he's also going to be Lando Calrissian in May, which, yes.
The guy is basically the coolest human on the planet right now. And, I mean, he's one of the few true Renaissance men left. He was writing for SNL like age 21.
Yeah. Tina Fey hired him straight out of NYU to write on 30 Rock. But, yeah, and I think I read that article second, and I think I liked it just as a juxtaposition between Quincy Jones over here, who's at the end of his career, and he's had a long, successful career, and then Donald Glover here, who's kind of at the beginning of his career and just starting to get into the depths of his creative powers and his creativity, and how they each have done their journey their way. And like you said, Donald Glover is just one of the most interesting people just on the planet right now. And he just, like, Atlanta was such a revelation to see last year. And the poster that I saw of the character posters for the Solo movie with him as Lando Calrissian is just,
I mean, if you got to pick somebody to follow up on Billy D. freaking Williams, they did.
Yeah,
all
they
right.
Nailed it. Yeah.
I mean, the guy did. Billy D. Williams did sell Colt 45, and if that man can make Colt 45 cool, he could have done anything. So if you got to pick somebody to follow him, outside of
Chadwick Boseman, who's kind of busy being Black Panther right now.
Yeah, he's got a little going on right now too.
So, yeah, those are like the two you would have to have picked for that, and they're both gonna. I have a feeling they're both gonna have very good the first 6 months of this year.
Yeah, I think things are going to go all right for both of them. I got a couple of recommendations. First, a beer recommendation. Just because we have to do it, because it's maybe the seminal book on the subject, Tasting Beer by Randy Mosher. I cannot say enough how good that is. I know a lot of people out there, they enjoy drinking beer. They might even enjoy listening to beer podcasts. They're not so sure they'd enjoy reading about the subject. Yeah. There's something... It's such a sense science that it's not really the kind of thing that is conducive to books unless you're a pretty hardcore geek. But Randy did such an excellent job of taking the entire experience of beer, the history, the tasting of it, the enjoyment of it, the styles of it, and breaking it down into layman's terms, not to dumb it down, but to make it more accessible to people who might otherwise think that that level of understanding about beer and the beer industry is beyond what they could really hope to reach.
Yeah, I think there are two books that I would recommend if you want to start reading about beer. That one, Tasting Beer, and the other, The Brewmaster's Table by Garrett Oliver. Those are probably the two that I think would be the best for someone getting into beer.
Brewmaster's table can be dense, though, man. Yeah, that's a lot to digest. Pun intended.
Yeah.
Yeah. But definitely, I mean, that's the one and only book you'll ever need on beer pairings with food. And if you're drinking your IPA with literally everything you eat, more power to you, but you're doing it wrong.
Doing it way wrong.
Way wrong. My other recommendation is definitely not beer related, and it's definitely a few years old. But if any of you out there have not watched Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog.
Oh, my gosh.
Just stop and do yourself a favor, because it's basically the greatest thing ever put to film. I managed to rediscover it after having it floating around on my phone for like 3 years unwatched. And it, imagine this, if you're unfamiliar with it, it's a pretty short episodic series. Yeah. Like the whole thing will take you maybe 2.5 hours to watch in its entirety. It stars Neil Patrick Harris, Felicia Day, and Nathan Fillion. And it's essentially
the Joss Whedon All-Stars?
Yeah, basically. And it's essentially, yeah, where's Buffy? Essentially covers the, like, a superhero versus a supervillain from the perspective of the supervillain in the form of a romantic comedy, and it's a musical. It is the greatest thing on the planet. There's literally a song titled Bad Horse. If you need to know anything else, then clearly you're the wrong audience for it. So, yeah.
And I will say a preemptive recommendation for next week. Well, there'd be two, but I'll just mention this one. Black Panther comes out Friday, and as we've already said, we're both going to go see it this weekend.
See that
spoiler
movie.
Alert!
So we will be talking about Black Panther next week.
Yeah, and we will be providing Black Panther is a character in it. Spoiler.
And we will be providing beer recommendations for Black Panther.
Yeah, that's where we're going to be doing beer pairings with Black Panther.
Beer and movie pairings. That's a new one. I like that.
We basically just wanted an opportunity to nerd out about Black Panther for an entire episode and make it vaguely beer related, but we'll see what we can do. All right. Well, Carly, appreciate you being on the show.
No problem.
Definitely check out Bold Missy at 610 Anderson Street in Charlotte, North Carolina. They have a great tap room over there. Absolutely fantastic. Amazing beer. Definitely stop in and check them out.
All right, thank you, Carly.
That's about all we got today. Yep. People, thanks for joining us as always. Have another episode out for you next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. But until then, cheers, slancha, prost, ganbei, ching ching, and most of all, bottoms up.
See ya.